This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on March 24th, 2010. Tonight we're talking to John Sheehan. And John is an awesome ASP.NET MVC developer. He works with jQuery. He's done a bunch of cool stuff with, he had the jQuery snippets. He runs managed assembly. And recently he's got REST Sharp, which was the main thing we wanted to talk to him about. But first, let's start with your cool new job.
Okay. So in April, I will be starting as a developer evangelist for a company called Twilio. And Twilio provides a REST API for sending and receiving phone calls and text messages from your applications. So they really take all the complexity out of adding telephony to your apps. And so I'm going to go around telling everybody how great it is, hopefully, and then also be doing blog posts and how-tos and example apps and all that stuff.
Okay, and we talked a little bit about this at Mix, but it's not just a .NET related job, right? You're doing any kind of language that's related to talking to Twilio.
Yeah, pretty much. Since REST is platform agnostic, I'm learning all the platforms that can access it. So I'll still be doing a lot of .NET stuff, but .NET won't be my primary development tool for my day job anymore.
So it's REST-based, and the idea is Twilio allows you to send off SMS messages?
Yeah, it lets you actually make phone calls as well. So there's really two parts to it. There's the REST API, which lets you initiate actions, but there's also an interface for receiving phone calls and text messages. And the basic way that it works is you sign up for a number through Twilio. The numbers are $1 a month. You assign a URL to each phone number. So when your phone number receives a phone call, it'll make a post to your URL, and then your URL will return back some XML commands. Like there's six core verbs, like say, and then it'll do text-to-speech and read back whatever's in your say command, or gather numbers, or record audio and stuff like that. So there's six of those core commands, and you return them using simple XML, and they have their brand of XML is called TwiML. And it's really easy to generate TwiML. It's the most simple XML pretty much you can generate. So that's the one half of it. And then the other half is, let's say you have an application that needs to make outgoing phone calls or send text messages at any interval, then you would make a call against the REST API to initiate those actions.
So what are some examples of applications that people have built around Twilio?
There are a lot of them. Let me pull something up here. Relying on the magic of John Galloway to fill this gap with music or something. So some of the sample applications you might see is notifications is a really popular thing. There's a company out there that does server monitoring, and they use Twilio SMS to send out text messages and phone calls even when your servers are down for a certain amount of time. 37signals uses Twilio for their SMS functions in Backpack, I think it is. One of the projects that I built with it is that I play in a softball league and they needed a new weather hotline. And so instead of them having to sign up for a full-blown phone number, even a VoIP phone number, they got a Twilio number, and I wrote a simple app that lets people call in, get the latest status for the games. The league director can call up the phone number, enter a PIN number, and update the message for everybody else, and it also emails him any of the voicemails that come in. And you can actually build, it supports everything you need to build to pretty much build Google Voice functionality. It's just all via an API. Yeah, so that would be some of the more common things is notifications. And they have a developer contest every week where you can win a netbook based on that week's category. So I'm trying to look through there to find some other examples as well.
I think the Washington State Department of Transportation is doing something.
For ferry times?
For ferry times, and I think for traffic stoppages, delays, and things like that as well.
Yep. Oh, another thing that people use it for is lead generation. So if you are advertising through Google AdWords or something like that, and you want to put a phone number up, but you want to track where that phone call is coming from, you create a Twilio number, which just forwards to your main number, and then you will know how many calls came through on that phone number, how many hits you got on your ad.
Cool. So you got interested in Twilio partly out of your work with REST Sharp?
Actually, it's kind of the opposite. I have a company that I run on the side called RIM Systems, and RIM Systems does a lot of work with recreation organizations, amateur sports leagues, building them websites, helping them get up and running. That hotline is an example of something I've done through RIM Systems. And I have a new application that I'm working on that really needed voice and text messaging built in. There weren't really any good ways to do that when I first had this idea a couple of years ago. I looked into Asterisk and maintaining that and building that all up and leasing my own lines and all that. And I really would have had to have built Twilio itself to do what I wanted to do for this application. So once Twilio launched, I got very excited because this app that I wanted to build for so long was suddenly possible. It also, this app deals with a lot of other REST APIs like Twitter and Facebook and all these other things out there. And so I saw the need to be building lots of wrappers to access them via .NET, and that didn't really exist at the time. So I thought, well, heck, I mean, there's got to be a better way than just parsing XML by hand, as much as Miguel likes that, that I thought I should do something that takes all the complexity out of making calls to REST APIs, and REST Sharp was born from that.
We kind of took away one of my good questions. But so there's the parse your XML like a man. I mean, the question is, how much work are you doing over, you know, just, you know, doing some Xlink and just kind of digging through XML? Like, what's the advantage over just doing HTTP request and then do some parsing?
The big advantage is that you can write a simple POCO class and then I'll do the matching up against your XML. It does it with a little less ceremony than like the XML serializer or data contract serializer, that kind of things. So I don't really like attributes. So my original goal was I want to deserialize without any attributes. So there's a couple places where I've added in convenience things so you don't have to worry about it. Like if you have a property called product ID that's Pascal cased on your POCO, but your XML or JSON that's returned has an element named product underscore ID and it's all lowercase, REST Sharp will still make that connection and deserialize that for you. So it's a little smarter than the built-in .NET serializers. I guess maybe smarter is not the word, maybe clever is a better word to describe it. It's more convention-based instead of having to configure everything and clutter up your POCOs with a bunch of attributes everywhere.
It kind of, when I was looking at it, reminded me a little bit of like what a model minder does in MVC, except kind of assume, you know, if you've got an underscore that will ignore that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe it. I think one of the inspirations for it was the way Subsonic will generate from your database, but it takes column names that aren't, you know, the kind of naming style that we like in our C# objects, and it, you know, it renames them or it maps them to the property that is properly named. So that's, I even have code in there from Subsonic that does the same kind of matching. The other thing that it really takes care of so that you don't have to is it handles all the HTTP underpinnings that you would need to manage yourself, all the error handling, all the proper setup of the request, the compression, all of that stuff. And it kind of works around a couple of the oddities of HTTP web requests, if you make a request with HTTP web request and you hit anything that returns something other than a 200, it throws an exception.
This is something we ran into with Witty with the networking code. There was the HTTP 100 continue. Is that an example of the kind of thing you're looking at?
Yeah, and we've had, I don't recall if I've specifically addressed that one. I know it's come up, but nobody's reported an issue with how it's working right now. So I don't know if we have it right or wrong yet, but I haven't run into any issues with it and I've used it pretty heavily.
Okay.
That's another example of things that we want to handle so that you don't have to think about it.
That's the same kind of, I'll let you get back to what you're saying, but that's the kind of thing where like, it's so easy to write a very quick request, get some XML, you know, throw it on the screen and it's like, wow, you know, I'll post this code. This is awesome. And then that's exactly it. All those kind of weird oddities or, you know, how you deal with failure conditions or proxies or just, you know, making sure you have your compression.
Or like a DNS not resolving or like your network just being off completely, you know, situations like that. We give you a simple way to tell if the rest, if the request even completed at all, not even like if you got an HTTP error. Going back to the non-200 response code thing, response codes in REST are a valid way to transfer back information about what happened. You can have, you know, a response code that says, you know, 403 and still have a request body on it. That's not really an exceptional event with dealing with REST APIs. So we trap things like that and still give you back a response that you can work with. And we even still manage the response body like it was any other request, even when those non-200s are returned.
So you have support for all the different RESTful verbs. One thing that I've been thinking about lately with MVC2, there's that support for the XHTTP method options. I'm probably saying that wrong, but you know where you can what is it? XHTTP method, and then you're able to override whatever the method is that's being posted for RESTful requests.
So you put it in a header?
Yeah. And so it's got header, or it'll also do a hidden field. And I was looking around, and that's part of the GData specification, I think back in 2006. But I guess this is something where that's not really necessary for you because you're making direct HTTP requests. I mean, the only time, like, you're able to specify.
Use a delete verb or
right,
method.
Right.
Use a delete method, yep.
I guess the one time you might is if you were posting to an MVC-based API or another API on a server that couldn't handle those methods.
There are times that, like, proxies will like, block non-posts or gets because they don't think they're valid requests. So there are times where those just won't get through proxies. And another reason for that is that if you allow it to be overrided in a form element, then when you can submit to the API then via a web page instead of having to do it programmatically behind the scenes. So it lets you still hit the API through a web browser and specify what verb you wanted to use. Method. I can't call it verbs. If I keep calling them verbs, Daryl Miller is going to have my head. They're methods.
Methods, right.
Methods, yep.
So I didn't follow. Were you saying that is something then where you do support, you do that, like you'll send the headers, the method override headers in those cases?
I don't send it by default, but what you would do is you would just say, okay, this is a GET request, and then for each request, you can add headers to it.
Ah, right. Okay.
For every request. So then you would just add the XHTTP method header value, and then it would get passed along with the request like any other header would be.
Do you have some people using it so far? You're saying you're using it yourself. Are there some other people that are using this?
There is one large company, who I don't know if I'm allowed to disclose it, but I'm very wowed by their use of Rest Sharp for an internal reporting app. I think they have a guild of developers that might be using it, if you know what I'm saying. if you don't, it's
right.
Probably good.
It took me a bit.
Okay, yeah. I have a. You can leave that in there too. I don't know of what other people. I know what people are using it. It's getting downloaded. I'm getting issues reported. I'm happy with the responses it's getting since I especially haven't even released 1.0 yet. So I'm getting very close to that. Although we can talk about why that might be slightly delayed now. And yeah, so I know people are using it. They're finding bugs. They're reporting them. I just don't know any other specific examples.
That's actually kind of an interesting side note, is the whole, like, when is it 1.0? Because I know, like, when I was originally starting on Witty and some other projects, you know, they would be like 0.1.3, you know, and it's like, let's just, at some point, you know, we've been working on this thing for a year or whatever it is, let's mark it 1.0, you know, but it's kind of, you know, I think it's something where, like, commercial products are always like 2009 Pro Unlimited, you know, and then like,
yeah.
But on open source apps, like, we're, you know, we know, like, we're developers and we're like, well, it's not perfect yet. There's still issues.
Right.
It's never done, damn it.
Right, right.
That's right. That's right. So, like, you know, Ninject just had Ninject Forever released. I'm thinking maybe just making 1.0 Rest Sharp Forever just right off the bat.
Then do you have forever, you know, 0.1?
right. Forever 0.1, forever 0.2.
Nice.
See, what I don't get about open source versioning is, while we're talking about this, is once you've gone beyond about two decimal places, what's the point? Like, you know, like, or like TweetDeck, they're at 0.33, 0.2 right now. Why not just 0.34? Like, why
right
0.33, 0.2? What are they accomplishing by going that far? I don't
That's
understand.
A distinction that only makes sense to developers. You know?
Right. So when I do release this, it's actually just going to be Rest Sharp release 1, and that's going to be it. Rest Sharp release 2. It's not going to be like version 1, version 1.1. Like, I hope that I release them fast enough once 1.0 is out that there won't be like huge changes between 1.0 and 2.0. Like, 2.0 would, if it really is going to change that much, to just be a fork or a different project or something.
There's one fatal flaw there. Always when you release 1.0, you get a showstopper bug and you have to do 1.01 the next day. So if you do that, you'll go through your numbers pretty quick.
Maybe I'll do service packs.
I think you should just go with birds, you know, like Falcon, Rest Sharp Falcon release, and then, you know.
Or Star Wars planets, or
cool.
I think you should use the GitHub GUI, you know, the revision GUI as your version number.
Oh, right, like the little hash it generates for each commit.
Right.
So this
it's
is
version 1FC943.
Fork me.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I think it's a great idea, Kevin.
Wow. Wow. Well, is there more? I mean, it seems like a great project. It seems pretty straightforward what you're doing. I mean, is there more we should talk about?
Yeah, there is actually.
Excellent.
Okay, so if you let me give you a little backstory, and you can determine how much you want to include. So RestSharp was born for my, to scratch my own itch. And I got contributions from really great people. And one of those people included was Daniel Crenna, who built TweetSharp, which everybody knows. I mean, it's a great library. I use it all the time. I'm not going to build a Twitter wrapper with RestSharp since TweetSharp exists. He contributed a lot of HTTP error handling and stuff like that. I mean, really stuff that really helped a lot. Well, he decided that he didn't really like RestSharp after all and ripped out the internals of Hammock or of TweetSharp and created a new library called Hammock, which you can find at hammockrest.codeplex.com. So what I'm leading at is this could open up a good discussion about the fragmentation in the .NET open source community and if how people feel about that, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe that's not interesting.
No, I think that is interesting. I mean, and the whole, it took me a while to actually understand what forking is with Git and how it's not forking a project and all that, and it's just part of the flow. But I wonder if it does encourage it a little bit, because once you've forked a project, it's easy enough to just kind of start going off in your direction and doing some work. And you know what I mean? I wonder if that has to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm happy to see another .NET REST client. I have no problem with that at all. I mean, the more REST clients out there, the more exposure REST gets in .NET, the happier I am. And I mean, subsequently, the happier my employer is. But it's kind of weird that they do the same. They do pretty much the same thing. His is a little more mature because it's been used in, a more mature library. But at the core, they have the same goals.
So what are the big differences? I mean, was there a reason why it couldn't just be, couldn't be one project?
So the biggest difference is that he supports things like OAuth already because he needed that for Twitter. Twitter's a very needy API, as you're probably well aware of, working with Witty.
Yes, I am.
So there's a lot of things in there for rate limiting, caching. He built in a whole mocking layer out of the box. The one thing that it doesn't appear that he does, or that I shouldn't say he, that Hammock doesn't do the way RestSharp does is... It uses XML serializer, data contract serializer, all of those to do the deserialization. So mine by default has built-in serializers and deserializers that are more conventions-based and smarter. But he just uses the existing ones that are out there. And there's nothing in RestSharp preventing you from using that. You can swap out all the deserializers and serializers and use whatever you want. If you're getting back, let's say, something like OData, and you wanted to write an OData deserializer, even though I promised myself to talk about OData, you could still do that and still use the underlying HTTP framework to actually do the fetching of it and returning it. But at their core, in their hearts, they exist to do the same thing.
So is it the kind of thing where you could pull over a lot of the stuff that they've got and just merge it in? I mean, it's like the OAuth and all that kind of stuff, or is it just something where they're serving different enough purposes, they're both cars, but one's a sports car and one's a not sports car.
Or does it make you want to just kind of chuck RestSharp and use Hammock instead? How does it make you feel, John?
It hurts so much. I'm just kidding. There, yes to both of your questions in a way. There are parts that I definitely like better about the way Hammock works and that I probably will shamelessly steal because... well, the license allows for it, and if I can save the time building it, then I will. There's parts of me that wants to have the one good way to do it, and I don't know if that is RestSharp or Hammock, and if there is if having two causes harm to both of them, then I don't want to be responsible for that. Or if it causes harm to REST adoption within .NET, then I don't want to be the one that is responsible for bringing that rift into it, especially if mine is the inferior library, which I don't know yet because Hammock just came out 2 days ago. So I think things still need to shake themselves out a little bit to see what the differences are, or, what their goals are over the long term.
Yeah, the open source ecosystem inside of .NET is interesting. Like outside of the .NET world, I think people are less worried about having multiple libraries. Like in the .NET world, I think a lot of time everybody's looking for nfoo. It's like you want to, what is kind of the .NET library for this thing?
like the not what's the non-Microsoft version of this that they're going to steal from us in a year?
Right. But I mean,
oh, wait, sorry, John, I forgot you started there.
Hey, wait a minute.
I take that back.
No, but I mean, I guess part of it is like it's a small enough ecosystem that we worry that you'll bet on the wrong horse and then somebody will get bored with their open source project maybe and stop developing it or whatever it is, you know.
Right. And like I have another open source project that you mentioned, the jQuery snippets project, that's Visual Studio 2010 code snippets for jQuery. And there's like 135 of them. And I built it and I thought it was cool, but I'm already bored with it. And I don't really feel like maintaining it anymore. So I feel bad that the 900 people that downloaded it, that I don't want to update it anymore. So I'm almost participating in that worry on its own. So I guess that was one reason why I would be hesitant to create an inferior library if there was a superior one already out there.
Yeah.
This is getting very like therapist couchy for the John Sheehan open source project.
Well, you know, I do have one kind of related success story with that, though. I had a few projects that I'd worked on years ago. One was Cropper plugins. I don't know if you ever used Cropper. It was...
Yep.
Okay, so it was cool before like then enough other good enough free screen capture programs came along, Jing, and there's even that snippet thing inside, a snipping tool inside of Windows and all that. So you don't really have to download another one. But one thing that was cool about Cropper was it had support for plugins. And so I started writing a bunch of plugins, you know, capture to animate a GIF or, you know, capture and do something, time.
Capturing Cornify.
I did not do that one. That's probably why the project failed.
That's probably it, yeah.
But so it had just kind of lingered out there for a while. And then recently I saw someone had checked in a couple of patches. And I'm like, well, heck, you're a project admin. Go to town, you know? So all of a sudden there's a new release for it. I'm like, hey, that's cool. You know, and I did the same thing with a database documenter thing that was, you know, people were using a few years ago, and it turns out there's still some people using it. So I just, you know, the people that were checking in patches, go forth, you know, like you have rights. So I think, I don't know. I think that a lot of the time just publishing stuff is, you know, we don't have to worry so much about what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think other development communities outside of .NET have like less of a mentality around we need to make a project out of this, and more just I'm going to post like 20 repositories on GitHub of stuff that I built that might be interesting to you and might not, and if you like it, you can use it. If you don't, then whatever, it doesn't matter. It's not, you know, a project that needs maintaining and committers and, you know, mailing lists and all that.
Right.
So I think I'd like to switch to that sort of model with my code releases going forward, especially since a lot of the stuff the examples I'm going to be doing for my new job are not necessarily going to be full-blown applications or projects that are working out, but more just illustrative of what you can do with Twilio.
One other weird thing I thought with open source that's kind of heartbreaking, but I don't know what should have happened, is the whole, like one of the bigger .NET open source projects is from a just normal people using it point of view is paint.NET. And I was really bummed when they closed the source. And it was because people were downloading the source and then just putting their logo on it and selling it. And enough of that happened where people were just scamming with this thing that they ended up closing the entire source.
And oh, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, it's actually, it was like a year or more ago that it happened. And I kept reading people saying, you know, like, oh yeah, they closed the source. I'm like, nah, they must have read the license wrong or that can't be right. But you can't, there's no repository, there's nowhere you can download the source anymore.
Well, how was it licensed? Wasn't it licensed under like the BSD or MIT or something?
So it was, but, and so you can download the old code if you can find it, but the new...
Well, no, that's my point. They allowed that with their choice of the license.
Right. So that is true that does that. But on the other hand, it's a bummer that they saw that or thought that was necessary. Like you don't see that happening with nobody sells OpenOffice. Well, I'll leave out some obvious jokes. You know,
Would you like to make fun of Sun, Microsoft employee, or no. I mean Oracle? I'm sorry.
Yes, I don't even.
See, I thought you were gonna go when you said something that was sad or heartbreaking. I thought you were gonna go with the whole NDoc versus Sandcastle.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
There's so many heartbreaks
in .NET open source. I know it's sad. It's just it's a budding, but yet it's a budding wasteland. It's Mad Max.
What's that?
This is the .NET open source ecosystem.
No, I'm just kidding. I was making a, I'm too young to get that reference
joke. Oh, you get off my lawn. I'm going to Thunderdome you.
I don't get that one either.
Oh, shit. Okay, so apparently we have to expand the charter of the podcast to include a history of pop culture references that everyone on the podcast that hosts it is aware of.
Yeah, that should be in your little preview document.
We'll put it in the Here's show notes.
Yeah.
We'll call it Ancient History.
Mad Max was one of the Pokemons, something.
Yeah. I'm not that young.
Any Bugs Bunny's friends? What?
Oh, boy.
So, were we?
Well, we were talking about Rest Sharp, and then we were talking about Hammock, and then we were talking about open source in general. Did you want to get
Wait,
back?
What's Hammock?
Hammock was a fork of Rest Sharp.
Fork.
Oh. Well, does that have a banana method?
You know what's here? This is another interesting topic. I'll even break so you can cleanly edit it.
Okay.
So that's another interesting thing about open source projects in .NET. Okay, that was a terrible transition.
You want to try it again?
Yeah,
that was one of our better.
Speaking of terrible transitions.
So open source project names, like the things like, let me just try to think of one. Kayak is a HTTP library that you can embed in your projects, like a web server, embedded web server in C#. But if you have a problem with it, you can't find anything. If you search for Kayak and your problem, all you get is things about kayaking. Whereas,
which could be therapeutic, but not really.
It doesn't really help you solve your problem. So something like Rest Sharp has a pretty unique name. You're not going to really find other things. Have you guys had problems with any libraries getting help with them because they were poorly named and were hard to search for?
I've had the opposite problem. I've been trying to find normal everyday things, and all I get back are these damn open source projects. try searching for something about Apache history.
Yeah.
There are no Native Americans in those results.
You should Bing it instead of Google it. The first two on Bing are actual non-software related.
That may be an advantage that some of the small search engines have.
They're just going to completely ignore the geeks.
It's a decision engine.
They haven't screwed up their PageRank algorithm enough yet.
That's right.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not a problem.
No, well, I definitely think it is. I'm not thinking of a specific example, but I've continually run into this where you're like, okay, now I'll search on the project name and a keyword or some funky thing, you know what I mean? Or put a bunch of stuff in quotes.
So there happens to be a programming language called Subtext. So for a while there, I had heard about it, and I remembered coming across the link once, and so I kept trying to search for subtext, and I kept ending up at Phil's blog and the Subtext project, Phil being that guy, and I kept ending up at those places instead of this programming language. And I finally, you type in subtext programming, and you get articles about skinning subtext and contributing and stuff like that. And I don't remember what the arcane combination of keywords I finally tried that got me to that language, but... naming stuff sucks.
Well, that's
why. Yeah, you look through source codes and you see Thing One and Monkey and Hootie and var names all over the place.
Yeah,
right.
Which is at that point, a lot of the time, I'll go to the Open Directory project or the successor to the Open Directory project. Excuse me, Wikipedia. So I'll go over to Wikipedia and look. That was a dumb joke. A lot of the time for that, I'll just go to Wikipedia and look up the project name, and then they'll have some links there. I mean, for general stuff, but yeah, you can't really search it.
Yeah. So Rest Sharp was originally called Stillwater, which is a town nearby that there's a river that runs through it. And I thought, oh, Rest Sharp, that's Stillwater. It kind of, sounds similar. But I realized nobody was ever going to be able to find anything related to it. So I picked the generic, C# open source naming scheme. And while I don't really like the name, I'm happy I went with it because you can find it easily. Plus the .com and .org were available.
Yeah.
You should have called it Eskimo Joe's. Nobody gets that?
No.
I tried making a cricket noise.
There's an Eskimo Joe's bar in Stillwater, Oklahoma. It's a big, big, big college bar.
I think you should have called
it. Must be a different Stillwater.
You should have called it Twilight. You should have called it Twilight Vampire Project. Lady Gaga.
Exactly.
Facebook
Twilight
logins.
Lady Gaga Vampire.
Yeah, Facebook logins. It would have been the most popular open source project in the history of the world.
People,
with non-programmers.
If you could figure out a way for people to contribute patches by posting a comment, you would be completely set. The one other thing, and I mentioned this one before, but I think Boo, it's just so unfortunate, the name there, because it's a very cool language. And it's like, I mean, I just think like it fights against the search engine problems, like searching on Boo and searching on. And then also, you know, I just think, you know, hey, manager, I'm using Boo for this. And they'll laugh at you.
So once again,
are any of you old enough to remember when .NET first came out and you had to try to search for C# using Google?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Or .NET.
Or .NET.
Or yeah. ASP.NET. Now you have the opposite problem. If you're trying to search for classic ASP stuff.
Oh, it's impossible.
Yeah.
Which is that's the universe's way of telling you shouldn't be searching for classic ASP stuff.
Absolutely. But sometimes you want to write a historical article.
Back to Boo. Once again, Bang has your back, though. If you search for Boo, the first thing that comes up is an object-oriented statically typed programming language. So
here's a question about RedSharp.
Okay, good.
What kind of support does it have for things like, you know, caching HTTP headers for, you know, if modified since, e-tag support, any sort of special stuff for helping, you know, managing that interaction?
Right now it doesn't, but that's what I would consider on the roadmap for shortly after getting a working 1.0 release out. Like things like that, caching and async calls, and I guess the other two big outstanding things that it doesn't support that I really want to support are Mono and Silverlight. The problem with Silverlight and RedSharp is that Silverlight doesn't have synchronous web requests. They're all asynchronous. And so until I build async into the core library, I can't really support it for Silverlight.
Yeah, that makes things a lot more challenging. You either, right. And I mean, you don't want to solve anything by blocking, but you don't want to have conditional code. So you end up just, it can be a mess.
Right. And if you've seen the source for TweetSharp, it's conditionals everywhere. I mean, they have conditionals for Compact Framework, Silverlight, Mono. I don't think, maybe not for Mono, but for all the other variants of .NET. I'm assuming they're going to have another one for Silverlight WinPhone and Silverlight, you know, proper.
Well, so you did mention OData a little bit earlier, and I know you didn't really want to get into that much, but I mean, I think that'd be an obvious question people would just be thinking about at this point, because that's the big word right now. And I guess you were saying to me before, is there kind of different things, like RedSharp is addressing purely RESTful APIs, whereas OData works with APIs that publish OData, which includes schema and includes querying language and all that kind of stuff too. Is that
right? Yeah, and since our conversation at Mix about my love for OData, I've been slightly corrected on some of the finer points of what makes something RESTful or not by people much smarter than I am. And if people are interested in this,
Sebastian, didn't you?
I actually talked to him at Mix, and he was he was much less opinionated in person than he is on Twitter. But the guy you need to follow on Twitter if you want to learn about REST and, you know, all sorts of web services is Daryl Miller. Mm-hmm. All I know is he's from Canada, and he's very patient with me as he explains all the things that I don't know to me. And I appreciate all the time he spends educating me, because he's really smart. He really knows what he's talking about. So he has explained to me that OData is not as evil as I initially felt it was, since it's mostly just Atom. I still don't like it, like, in spirit. I think if you look at, like, I went to work for Twilio because I really appreciated the design of their API, not just because I needed a job in the old place. I really liked it. So if you look at that API versus, like, an OData endpoint, they're not really... They may do the same thing, but they're not really spiritual kin. Does that make sense? No?
I don't know about the spiritual kin part.
Okay, so I'll back it up, maybe. So if you compare like a traditional REST-based API to something like OData, they're not really... They may do the same thing, but they're not really the same.
So what's the big difference?
So from my perspective, it looks like OData... it serves back Atom feeds, which are not really they're not really human readable, and they're not really designed to be. I mean, the way you consume it in Visual Studio is through add service reference. So you don't need to understand what it's doing as long as your tool does, which is fine. But that tooling support doesn't really exist outside of .NET right now. So in that regard, to me, it's not really cross platform. If to maximize its use, you have to have, you know, a $500 IDE or how much ever Visual Studio costs to consume it properly, that to me isn't really a cross-platform thing. Whereas the APIs out there that are considered more RESTful, you could look at the XML and you know what the data is that you're looking at, and it's easily parsable. It's, you know, there's, you know, I guess, libraries for it across platforms. And there may end up being libraries and other frameworks for OData. I mean, it's not really that different from GData. Is that right? Does anybody know?
Yeah, it's pretty different.
It's pretty different?
Yeah.
Just the same delivery mechanism, but everything else is...
So it basically, I mean, the OData, from what I can remember, and I haven't looked at this for a couple of weeks, basically just reuses Atom entities or Atom elements and types as return. But it's not the Atom publishing protocol, which is really what GData is more about. And there was some kerfuffle about the fact that some of the entity framework stuff was embedded into the descriptor language and things like that, but I'm not as concerned about that because basically I do a call to an endpoint, I get back Atom, and I can consume that with a multitude of libraries on different platforms, and I don't really care about the descriptor as much, which I don't know, maybe makes me sound cavalier, but I tend to treat data as data, and I don't really care if there's a schema because yeah. I'm just not that anal retentive about the data. I figure if I'm writing code to deal with data, that it's going to deal with whatever data comes down the pike. And you know, it's going to be somewhat obvious, and I don't really lean on tooling support to help me deal with the data. Maybe that just comes from years of not having tooling support and then you know, primarily dealing with JSON data. So you know, you don't really care, you know, whether or not this is a long int or a string or maps to this particular entity in your schema.
Right. And I guess that's one thing I don't like about OData is that it contains all that metadata that you don't need. Mm-hmm. And so you're really just increasing your payload overhead for, I mean, the benefit of the tool, you know, Visual Studio.
Right. It's the same problem that I had with SOAP is you had this huge SOAP header that right. described everything. And all you really cared about was, you know, like 10 lines in the middle. And you could parse that out with any old XML parser and just, you know, all I care about is the payload.
Right.
That's exactly. really all I care about.
Exactly.
And it's the same thing with the rest of it. I know there's kind of two schools of thought on data formats in general, whether it's JSON or XML or relational, is that, you know, there's the, you know, just give me the data and I'll deal with it. Because really there's only two types. There's string and binary when you look at it. A string may represent numbers or other things like that, but you can figure it out
right.
one way or another. And then there's the kind that, you know, I need to know everything that's in there because, you know, for whatever reason, I need to know exactly what type that is. And I've never understood the latter type. I don't understand why people need to have that tight of a handle on what their data is, I guess.
Well,
primarily because they're in statically typed languages, and if they get back something that doesn't map correctly, then they have to go through hoops to coerce it or infer what type it might be.
Right, yeah. And that's one reason for RestSharp's existence is that you define what the data is with your C# objects and not somewhat, and then it deserializes from there instead of bringing in the data and trying to find a matching C# property for the XML element. So it kind of does it the reverse of some other serializers that are out there. So I've tried to remove that needing to deal with the parsing. If it's sending back some strange data thing that can't parse easily to a date or whatever else, you just set it to string and it just gets the value out of it.
Now, I mean, we should probably talk to somebody that knows more on the OData side. I don't know if there's a way. Well, because I'm curious about this. I do think that, you know, it is nice to be able to explore through something with, you know, with a tool. I don't know real world how much of your time is going to be exploring data versus just consuming an API. You know what I mean? Like it's cool to be able to say, oh, let me point Excel at Netflix and kind of, you know, explore around. But or LinkPad or whatever, but in the real world, what percentage of your time are you doing that? But I wonder if there's a way, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a way where you can say, don't send me the metadata. You know what I'm saying? I do know, I just, while we were talking here, I looked at the OData service for Nerd Dinner, which I worked on, and when you return JSON, there's no metadata goop at the top. It's just straight JSON objects, which would have to make sense because it's just strings.
Yeah, and some of the OData feeds that I looked at for, who was that? I don't remember now. Anyway, but when I looked at them, they were just Atom entities. I think there weren't even any OData specific namespaces that I saw in the document that got returned, the XML that got returned. So that's maybe why I wasn't too concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at these dinners, and it does say type equals nerd dinner model dot dinner, but it doesn't have a whole bunch of, you know, this is an int, this is a string, this is whatever.
That's in the JSON you said?
That's in the JSON, yeah. So
can you send me that link quick?
Yeah.
I wanna look at it and see if RestSharp out of the box would parse it.
I think with OData, a lot of that the data type stuff is in the whatever they call it, the CSDL,
mm-hmm.
the descriptor language, which I don't know. It's, you know, halfway to it. I feel like when you start going down that road, you're halfway to SOAP again.
I think that's a perfect way to describe it. This is like sitting right in the middle between SOAP and REST. Do you agree? Or, yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
That's why it's evil. It's RESTful SOAP.
Or SOAPy REST.
SOAPy REST. I like both of those.
Well, I mean, part of the original idea with REST is it is supposed to, just by following the conventions, it's supposed to be something where you can explore pretty much anyways, right? Like you hit a URL, you get back an XML file that's got the conventions where you've got, okay, here's my list of products. And so then I would just say, okay, /ID, and I get product number one by ID. And then I would say, you know, I mean, like where you can just kind of spelunk by URL. Is that right?
Okay, so here's one place where I will mention that it's probably irresponsible that I'm writing a REST consumption library because I'm not like a, you know, the Restifarian that they get called. I just needed to consume a bunch of APIs and need something to do it faster. So, but I know there are people out there that get very defensive when you start saying that REST is about the URL or clean URLs is REST. I think it's more just like a byproduct of a good REST API design, but not necessarily a key tenet of building a RESTful service. If you know, people that organize their stuff well will end up having good URLs that are hackable.
Yeah, but one of the tenets of, you know, quote unquote true REST is what they call hypermedia as the engine of application state, which means that you don't just start hacking around URLs, right? The results that you get back from the entry point to your service contains embedded in it the resource address, the URLs for the resources that are embedded in that response. So, you know, people, and I think this is one of the negatives of OData that I've seen also, is that, you know, they sort of take this, we'll hack around in the XML, I mean, hack around in the URLs sort of approach, or at least that's one option. So they have URL templates and you fill in fields here and you fill in fields there, rather than have those transitions given back to you as embedded in the embedded URLs in the service responses, if that makes sense.
I think it makes sense.
So I think the REST purists, quote unquote, would, you know, are big on that model, hypertext, you know, hypermedia model.
Right. So the guy you want to have the theoretical discussion about REST is, again, Daryl Miller, because he's the guy you want. He's smart.
Yeah, so I looked him up. He's at bizcoder.com.
Yep, that's him. And see, he's a big fan of the WCF REST toolkit, which is actually one of the things that I started using when I was going down the road of trying to build wrappers for all these APIs. One of the original APIs that I thought would be a good litmus test for how good my library was would be the Amazon S3 API. And I started trying to wrap that with the WCF REST toolkit. And it wouldn't let me get low enough to build the kind of things I needed to build. For example, so Amazon S3 uses kind of a crazy authentication scheme. You take your whole request, you hash it against your secret key, and then you include that hash in the request, and then it verifies all of that. And so the WCF REST toolkit HTTP client wouldn't let me set the header I needed to set to pass that hash along. And that's when I really started going down the road of building my own library that let me control all of it from beginning to end.
Well, that may end up being a good call, because I don't know what happened to that library. Like it never, that was one of those libraries that was, you know, there was experimental, maybe going to make it into .NET 4.0, and it didn't, as far as I know.
It didn't. You're
so
correct.
It's kind of in limbo now, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. So, John, I'm trying to look at this JSON to see if it's parsable. And if it is, I take back every bad thing I ever said about OData.
You're far too quick to take back everything bad.
Well, see,
you've already been blackballed.
That's my thing. I try to be constantly aware of how stupid I am.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it does have types included, but it doesn't have a bunch of metadata. And it looks like it's kind of standard JSON stuff. So
Eval it, see what happens.
No, it has the Microsoft thing where it has the D at the beginning, you know, so you can't just eval.
Oh, strip it and eval it.
Yeah.
Because that's foolproof.
Okay, Scott, did you have anything you wanted to say on the whole REST business?
On the REST business?
Or anything so
other,
far.
Other than you'd like to get some?
Yeah, I like to sleep. Now, I had a lot of interesting thoughts, but I enjoyed just listening to it, so...
You had a lot of interesting thoughts you just didn't want to share with us.
We're at an hour. I'll put it that way.
How do we know that they're interesting thoughts?
Right.
If you don't share them, you might have thought they're interesting.
I'll type up a report. You can read it in the morning.
Okay. So I'm happy to report that I think out of the box or with very little modification, it would parse this pretty successfully.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
So I'm going to try it, actually. And then if I get it working by the time this goes live, I will post a public apology and redaction in the show notes.
Well, now this is JSON. I mean, I can see more of what you're saying about the XML side of it.
Yeah, the XML might still suck.
But one thing that ReshArp does is it automatically figures out, you know, what the request is sending back. In a way, you know, it uses accept headers properly.
Yeah.
So JSON is on the deserialization front is an equal citizen to XML and ReshSharp. On the serialization, like request bodies, JSON needs a little work. But on parsing results, JSON is on par with XML. It's actually a little bit better because JSON has dictionaries that XML doesn't have, and it supports those too.
Nice.
So if JSON is built into OData, if that's like a is that just Microsoft's implementation of it?
I guess if it's kind of one and the same.
If it's a core feature of it and not like some add-on or, you know, some...
Oh, it's a core feature.
You need to do...
You go to the OData website and it talks about the different formats and
okay.
XML
then,
and JSON.
Then I'm fine with, you know, parsing JSON instead of the XML. If it's going to be there for everybody.
Yeah. So we'll have that link in the show notes, but it's whatever at the end of your thing. At the end of your query, you say $? format equals JSON.
And, yep.
Because if they didn't include it out of the box, Douglas Crockford would come over with his laser beam eyes and kill them all.
And he was there at Mix. So.
And he does have laser beam eyes.
And he would have done it.
I went to talk to him, and I was like too intimidated to even tell him I liked his book. Like, for fear that he would say, "You are not worthy of my book." Okay. He scared me.
But you were in the picture with him.
Oh, that's true. I do have a nice picture of me with him. Except for he doesn't know I'm in the picture with him. That's how afraid of him I am.
So it seems like a good time for a lightning round. If we can wake up K. Scott.
Okay, I'll unmute my microphone again. And sit up straight.
Are the sound effects added in post-production?
Post, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, they're post-production. So, in our studios.
You get to see how the sausage is made now.
Just imagine.
I'm so disappointed.
All right, lightning round.
Oh yeah, lightning round. This is where I'm supposed to ask questions, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we're just a couple weeks away from Mix, where there was a number of exciting announcements, and I'm just wondering what was the most exciting announcement for each individual that's participating in this podcast this week. So, Mr. Galloway.
Oh, good. Well, I was happy. I think I knew some things, so I wasn't as surprised with, but IE9 I was pretty happy with. My quick, because it's lightning, but I like the fact that they're doing every 8 weeks, there's a new preview that comes out. That's cool. I like the SVG, of course, because, you know, that's I always talk about the SVG. I was just very happily surprised with how it was moving. And in general, you know, moving towards HTML5 and all that. So good stuff.
What was the saying? HTML5 done right? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, which I don't know if that's kind of a, you know, well, we can't do it right, so we're not doing that part. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure what exactly those words meant. But I did. Oh, and one other thing that I thought was awesome was, you know, it's at least for the preview, which is at ietestdrive.com, I think, you can download it and install it without it affecting your other browsers. And so I did, and it was great. I mean, it's not a full browser yet, but I was able to test things out, browse websites and play with it, and it did not affect my other browsers. So very happy with this.
Cool.
No reboot.
So John, you were there. What did you think was good?
So I'm not a huge fan of Silverlight in the browser. The same way I don't really like Flash in the browser. I really like, you know, using the big three HTML, JavaScript, CSS. But I really like Silverlight as a cross-platform app development tool, whether that's on the phone or out of browser stuff. So I'm really excited for Silverlight on the phone. Anything that presents a reasonable opportunity to be a viable alternative to the iPhone, which I have a very strong love-hate relationship with, and that I could actually build an app for, is exciting to me. I hope they take care of some of the problems that came up, like the copy and paste thing and the other issues. And I hope it doesn't lower the bar so far that the marketplace is just overwhelmed with apps. I think they have a real opportunity with the marketplace to eat into Apple's tyranny over the App Store. So that's the thing that excites me the most.
Very good. Kevin, what did you think?
I think I have to go with the IE9 thing also. Although I remain an IE skeptic, because with these things, the devil is in the details, and there's still a lot of details that we don't know. Like, for example, when is this thing going to be available? They didn't announce that. I mean, is it, we would have to wait 2 more years for this or not? You know, what exactly there is and isn't going to be covered? You know, from the sound of it, you know, SVG is in, but Canvas is out, so that's kind of a bummer, at least so far. To me, IE represents the least common denominator browser platform, and so if they move that forward, you know, taking a significant step toward where the rest of the browser world is, I'll be happy. I certainly don't expect myself to be running IE9, you know, as my primary browser, so I'm not too excited about it as a user, but as a developer, you know, I think they're doing the right things.
You're a Firefox man, right?
I am. I want to be a Chrome guy, but there's just a couple of extensions that I can't live without yet.
Huh.
So I'm hoping they go to Chrome, you know, that they show up on Chrome at some point, because I would actually like to use Chrome.
Chrome guys are the new Firefox guys. It's like, it's cool to be the Chrome guys now, and Firefox guys are just the laggards, like it used to be with Firefox and IE.
So who's Opera then?
What's the Opera?
All right, Scott K.
So having spent the last 2 days skinning a website and having it look exactly the same in Chrome, Safari, and Firefox, and then look different in IE, I got to say IE9 was probably my big highlight. Just the fact that it'll support native CSS3 border-radius. It's going to be a huge, huge thing, personally. And as soon as IE9 launches, I'm going to launch the Ditch IE8 and IE7 campaign. But on a kind of a secondary level, I was happy to see that the primary development model for Windows Live Active Phone Hailstorm Series 7 apps will be Silverlight, just because I'd kind of, when they first announced they were going to do a WinMo 7, I'd kind of said, you know, if they don't do the UI in Silverlight, they're just stupid. Because it would just be, and you know, obviously they were not that stupid. They realized that, you know, doing it the old Windows Forms mobile, whatever horrendous way you had to do it on WinMobile 6.5 and earlier, I just wasn't going to cut it anymore. And they needed something that was going to really, really show the support of .NET devs and make the iPhone devs, you know, wonder why they're beating their head against Objective-C, even though I don't think it's beating your head as much. But I was a little, frankly, surprised to find out that the IE browser on Mobile 7 won't support Silverlight in the browser. I thought, you know, surely they could find some way to sandbox that and get it running, and that would, you know, be a huge poke in the eye to iPhone. But I guess they decided not to.
It seems to me that decision is like completely based around not wanting to undercut the marketplace. So like, if you can only get Silverlight apps through the marketplace, then people can't release them via the web, which I don't
Correct,
know if that's...
That doesn't mean that you have to allow Silverlight in the browser access to native phone APIs.
That's true.
So, you know, there's no location unless you do some hokey JavaScript thing. No access to the phone, no access to the dialer, no access to contacts and whatnot. So maybe they're hoping that they get tons of game developers developing natively for the Wind Mobile phone.
Well, from the sound of it, the web browser on the phone is nowhere near what, for example, the iPhone mobile browser is, which I think is a huge mistake.
Nothing is even close to WebKit. It's I don't know. Like I said, I've spent the last 2 days, you know, just staring and styling and the two easiest have by far been Safari and Chrome, although Safari has its own quirks. But, you know, Firefox has caught up in a lot of ways, but things just look better in WebKit-based browsers to me, Safari especially. I don't know if it's just the font rendering or if it's everything just, I mean, the corners look sharper. Everything looks sharper in a Safari in WebKit browsers.
So there's no reason for them to ship web, no reason that Microsoft sees for them to ship WebKit on the desktop. That's fine. That makes sense. But really, what's preventing them from doing a WebKit-based browser
Pride.
On the phone? Just ego?
Well, it's the whole, and this is all conjecture because who knows what they're thinking. But I think a lot of it, it's not only pride, but it's also, you know, this cultural fear of not owning the IP. They ship jQuery, but they haven't been contributing to it. Now they're going to start contributing to it. And I'm interested to see how that's going to pan out. But yeah, there's just no way they're going to include, you know, a different open source rendering engine in one of their, you know, that they'd be like admitting defeat. And, you know, and the IE rendering engine is embedded in so many things within Windows and all the different apps. There's just no way that they could just plop in WebKit.
And it's too bad the browser isn't up to snuff. To me, what's the point in rushing out the door if it's not going to be on par? Like, I don't even need it to exceed what's out there right now. I don't need the next generation. If you can just give me something that is a viable replacement browser-wise, email-wise, app-wise to the iPhone, then I'm there because the iPhone drives me crazy that I can't get Google Voice on it. So I wish they would just, if they're just going to wait, or if they're just going to come out behind, just wait until they're on par. That's what I would wish they would wait for.
Well, do you think you'll get Google Voice on the Windows phone?
Sure, why not? There's no competing.
There's no competing between Microsoft and Google?
There's not a conflict of interest like there is between Apple and Google. I mean, I sure they compete.
I think that was true when Windows wasn't, I don't know. I'm not going to say that, but I think it'll have an easier time getting on the Windows phone than it does on the iPhone, for sure, because Google really wants to kill Apple, but Apple doesn't really care about Google.
Well, they're starting to, though.
I was just having this conversation with a friend the other night, and, you know, and it's kind of fun to watch the two, because, you know, Google really, really wants to kill Apple, but, you know, Apple is just more concerned about selling more hardware. And that's kind of where, well, I don't know. I don't want to get into a whole phone marketing conversation.
The lightning round.
Scott K has used up his next lanterns.
I'm like the kid who's borrowing against Christmases in the future. Scott, you can't answer questions for the next 10 lightning rounds now. I'm sorry.
Hey, do you think the Microsoft Hearts jQuery thing is going to work out?
This is the lightning round question?
Yeah.
Maybe. I'll be interested to see two things. A, if jQuery gets re-dual licensed or triple licensed under MSPL. And two, what exactly their contributions are and how they get licensed and accepted. Because there's been a lot of pushback in the forum on their templating proposal in that Microsoft and some other people really want it in the core. But a lot of the majority of the community seems to think that it's just better off as a plugin. And so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Interesting.
I think the community is right on that one. It's a common use, but it doesn't seem to me to be like as core as the things that are in the core already.
Well, and there's so many things. Well, it's there's all sorts of weirdness there because autocomplete's in the core. Is that really a core functionality of jQuery?
Autocomplete's in the core. They want it in the core UI or in the core?
It's in jQuery core. I think
autocomplete is not in the jQuery core. It's in jQuery UI.
jQuery UI.
Yeah, which is a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they want it in the core of jQuery UI or do they want it in the core of jQuery proper?
The templating and data binding they want in jQuery core.
Right, okay. So they should put it either in UI or make it a plugin.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know that it really belongs in UI either, but I don't know. I could almost see the data binding going in, but then you gotta, you know, you kind of wonder, well, what am I binding against? Well, a template, and I don't know. I don't know what's gonna pan out with that, but I think it's interesting that they've kind of accepted it so readily, and that their recommendation going forward is that no one use the ASP.NET Ajax for client-side development. They just encourage the use of jQuery. And that's I think that was at Mix where they pretty much said that. They said, you know, use jQuery for client-side development. And there's not going to be any more resources put towards ASP.NET Ajax going forward.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
All right. One more lightning round question for everyone. And you only get 10 seconds to answer. And because John will edit you and cut out anything after 10 seconds. But what I'm trying to find out is no one really mentioned the Windows 7 phone from a consumer experience. We talked a little bit about the development tools and Silverlight is on there, and that's all great. But as far as I know, no one here now owns a Windows Mobile smartphone anymore. I finally gave mine up last year too. So I'm wondering if, let's say in 6 months, there's the Windows 7 phones out there, the iPhones out there, some new Android devices out there. Someone gives you $700, go buy any phone that you want. What would you buy, Kevin?
Probably an iPhone. I mean, I haven't seen the Win phone yet, but you got to remember that iPhone's going to have another hardware generation come out before the Win phone 7 even hits the streets. Mm. And probably a new major OS upgrade also. So,
John.
Damn you.
Yeah.
I'm not done.
Save it for the next
show. I'm going to let you finish, John, but I just got to say.
I think the Windows phone looks very cool from a development point of view, and I do like the UI from what I've seen so far. The one other thing is the ecosystem, what apps are available, and what I can install and all that kind of stuff, and that's something I'm still thinking about. But I do like the UI, and I love the development experience.
John with an H.
I pretty much agree with John and Kevin. I want so badly to want to own something other than an iPhone, but it's got to do everything the iPhone does. It needs a real web browser with HTML5 and Geo and all that stuff. But I do like the UI on Windows 7 phone, but I'd probably end up doing an iPhone because it's going to be so far ahead.
Cool. Scott.
1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005.
You already used your 10 seconds.
1007, 1008, 1009. iPhone.
All right, interesting. Myself, I really love the Android device, but the development tools for it just suck. So if there's any reason for me to change, it would be because I want to write my own software for something.
You know,
how do you really feel?
Now, to clarify that a little, though, they do suck, but you don't have to buy a computer in order to install them.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. They don't suck, but they don't suck really, really bad, like some other specific phones.
Right.
That's true. The hardware dongle to do iPhone development is expensive.
That is, and then the classic, you know, development for BlackBerry or development for Windows Mobile Classic or whatever you call it. Those,
or Symbian.
Right. None of those are very... So I think Android development tools suck, but maybe suck a lot less than a lot of other... than just about everything. I don't know.
Has anyone here tried writing an app for the Palm Pre or Pixie 9?
Nine.
I haven't either. But you apparently, I mean, you can download the simulator for free. You can download the OS for free, and you can then the development tools are HTML, JS, and CSS.
Hmm.
Have you held a Palm Pre in your hand?
Yeah.
That was the cheapest feeling device I've ever felt.
It's a wee little phone. I got big hands, so it doesn't work too much for me. But I can see where there's a market for tiny hands or tiny phones for tiny hands.
For male supermodels. Zoolander, possibly. Anybody?
Right.
Is that is Zoolander too new for you guys?
That's too new.
Okay, sorry.
Is that one of those new vampire movies?
Yes.
Was that made after 96? That was the last year I've been to the theater.
Stars Jerry Stiller, right?
Yes, exactly.
Does that conclude the lightning round?
Oh, yes, that concludes the lightning round.
And actually, you don't have to use the Java... tools to develop Android apps. You could go with something like I can't think of the name. Well, Appcelerator and that other one that's out of Vancouver, PhoneGap.
Well, there's that. Hmm. There's also on the way is the MonoDroid, which has been...
Yeah, it goes without saying.
And yeah, then, that could be interesting.
Yeah.
They probably already have the libraries for the Windows Phone Series 7 out for Mono somewhere in the trunk.
Well, yeah, but at that point, you know, you're just... I mean, that's Silverlight development.
They ported Mono to Silverlight.
Right. Also, with Android, there's that. There's also a native development. So if you wanted to write C++, you could. And
oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah,
I'd rather stab myself.
Actually, I'm doing it right now. It's kind of fun. Watch. So all I do is I've got a pointer to a pointer to a pointer, and then I dereference it.
Young guy question, what are pointers?
Why don't I just embed assembly inside of an Ada program?
There we go.
All right.
That was rapid fire action lightning round.
Great. Okay. Well, okay.
Tune in again next week because we're going to get faster every week.
Right. You know, I can just speed up the audio. So I should, as we're finishing up, I should give you the chance, John, to talk about, you talked about your new job. We mentioned jQuery snippets a little bit. And then there's managed assembly. What's the story there?
The Pimp Your Stuff segment.
Yeah, we're officially in the Pimp Your Stuff segment. Oh, we need music for a segment. I need pimp music now. All right.
Okay, so Managed Assembly is a little community website I put together in the vein of Hacker News for .NET developers. So it's a link sharing and discussion site. It really, really needs an audience. I'm trying the best I can to stick with it. But if you want to get your links or discuss.net, that's the place to hopefully do it. And if you want to take over the site, you can also do that. You can email me.
You just click a link and become admin.
Right, exactly. It's on a rotating basis. Up for it, next.
Well, John, that sounds like an excellent server tools online ninja group project.
It does. It really does. In fact, yeah, I'm not going to say anymore.
So how does this compare then with something like .NET Kicks?
Well, it looks different.
Now it has less spam.
Okay.
Right, because there's no audience. See, like, if you don't have an audience, you don't have a spam problem. It's great. I just told that to James the other day. I'm like, James, if you really want to get rid of all the spam, just get rid of all your users, and then you're good. It works more like Hacker News does with the voting, and it allows for discussions, which .NET Kicks doesn't. And I don't want to disparage .NET Kicks too much because I love that site. I've used it. I'm one of the top users on there. Plus, I like James. But this is more focused around links and discussion, and .NET Kicks is more focused around advertising. See, I said I wasn't going to try to say anything bad, and then I did anyway.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. The whole comment threading stuff with Hacker News.
Right.
Cool.
So it's in need of an audience and a new caretaker.
Excellent. Okay. So if somebody does want to, I mean, they can just contact you, Twitter. Or
yep.
Whatever.
Yeah, there's email addresses on.
Maybe you could have James acquire it for like a Twinkie or something.
We have been in discussions over it, but he already owns the rest of the .NET internet sphere, so it's like the last holdout.
Oh.
I'm still skeptical. Like, what's he doing with all this stuff? He's going
to... He's going to convert it all to Rails. He and Rob Connery.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like when the car companies went around and bought up all the railroads so they could shut them down.
Right.
Well, you know, Reddit used to be written in Lisp, and then someone came along and rewrote in Python. Ooh.
Anything else you want to pimp?
No, that's all. Just check out Twilio, Twilio.com.
Excellent. Okay.
Was that evangelist-y enough?
I think so. All right.
Now you have to buy us all free drinks at the bar.
That's right.
All right. The next conference you're at that I'm at, it's on me.
Okay. I'm going to wrap this up, lest the lightning rounds start back up. So thank you very much for joining us on Herding Code. Thanks a bunch, John.
All right. Thanks, guys.
We'll catch you next week.
Can you hear me good?
Pretty good. There's kind of a hum going on. Not bad. What?
There's also a lot of commotion.
Sorry.
Oh, is that you?
That was me.
Are you drumming or fighting?
Being attacked by your cats?
I dropped something on the microphone. Like a keyboard.
A beer.
Awesome. Wow. Okay, what's that noise? This is Name That Funny Noise. This portion of the podcast is called Name That Odd Noise.
Is there still a hum? Besides the person eating the hard candy?
Just a second. I'm adding Scott in. We'll just keep the conversation going. Once he's here a bit, he might. All right, you there? Scott?
Hello?
Scott is there. Hooray!
Oh, my God.
Okay, so we're talking about open source and .NET and stuff.
Oh, case got dropped.
Oh, man.
We only have one Scott on the program.
Love conservation of Scots.
Yes.
He's not destroyed. He's just been turned into energy. So we're okay.
I'm pretty sure he always was energy. So
at least his hair was.